That's going to serve you well.
We'll call the House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development to order for Thursday the 22nd. Apologize to the committee members for our missing a meeting on Tuesday. Hopefully you enjoyed the somewhat unanticipated conversation or vacation and come with some good questions for today's conversation. We're going to have an informational hearing on the relationship between sustainability and economic development as it fits with transportation. Have a number of folks to help us begin that conversation, and so I'll open the informational hearing and invite Fred Hansen, General Manager of TriMet, up. He's got some interesting things to tell us. We appreciate you being here and eager to hear what you have to say.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. For the record, I'm Fred Hansen, General Manager of TriMet, the public transit system in the greater Portland region. What I wanted to be able to do today is really talk about two elements of what we do. One is what we within the TriMet area are able to do relative to sustainability, how important those efforts are, not just from an environmental standpoint, but how they have, in fact, consistently saved us money, made more important investments for the region as a whole in terms of mobility, and how those are really connected and not in competition. And then secondly, to be able to turn to the some of the national issues, because I've been involved in some of those issues, and it might be helpful just to be able to have some sense of some of the things that are happening in that arena as well. Well, first, let me talk a little bit about TriMet itself, just to be able to give at least some of the members who are not familiar with us just a sense of it. We cover the urbanized areas of the three counties, Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah counties. It's 575 square miles. The population of our service area is about 1.3 million people. By the way, the border is about the urban growth boundary. It's not exactly, but it's very, very close to that. And although here in FY08, it shows a 99.1 million rides per year. We actually moved a little bit over that as we're moving into FY09. A little bit also about our riders. 71% are what we call choice riders. That is, they have a vehicle or access to a vehicle, but choose to be able to utilize our services. And it's important because if you think about a place like Los Angeles, they run about 75% are what would be called transit dependent. That is, they have no choice but to be able to ride. Part of the reason why that's so significant in our region is it means that we are in competition in many ways with the automobile, and so we have to be able to provide a level of service, a quality of service that is really attracting those people to us. Not only does it make good economic sense, but it makes good time management sense and other things as well. More about our rider, they are median age is 37, 54% are single, about a $50,000 household income, which is slightly below average in the Portland region, 34% college educated, which is a little bit higher than the average. But in truth, what is there is they are a cross-section of our community. The ridership is not much different than the community as a whole. And again, what it says is that we're attracting people from across both the economic strata as well as the geographic strata utilizing our services. It's always difficult to be able to compare one transit system to another across the country. It's kind of too much apples and oranges comparisons, but the closest apple to apple comparison is really a ridership on a per capita basis. And if you look at this, it's really quite amazing to be able to have the Portland region be seventh in the nation on a per capita ridership. And short Honolulu, which because of the nature of the land constraints and so on, is maybe a bit of an anomaly. All of the other cities that are higher here, and even many of those that are lower, are older, well-established, many of them having historic rail or subway systems, and yet to be able to see a relatively younger western city, medium-sized, that is ranking up there, just indicates the level of use of the system and why I think that's so important. Part of it you can see with this is really comparing not all large metropolitan areas, but really systems that are about the same, or cities that are about the same size as we are. It goes from the smallest on the left to the largest population-wise in terms of service area. But what you see is annual boardings per resident very, very high in the Portland region. And really, it's also a Northwest story because second highest is Seattle, although with a quite a bit larger population. Part of the reason why those numbers are so high is that our service isn't just about that work trip. It's not just about the Monday through Friday work trip. In fact, it is used, our fastest growing area, not the largest segment, but the fastest growing segment, is for non-work related trips, for recreation, the Blazer game, going to the zoo or Saturday market or a movie or whatever it might be. And those that we weekend boardings is very, very important. And if you look at the service hours, that is the amount of service we actually put out on weekends, and compare it to other communities, you see why, because we really do provide lots of service on those other hours, and it's very important from the standpoint of attracting riders. Well, just a couple more slides here and just general background, but regional trends I think is very important. The top two bars of this graph tell one story, and that is, as we have seen over the decade, 1996 through 2006, and the national database, that's National Transit Database, is a little slow in getting the most recent information, and we pull it from this. But what you see here in this decade is that ridership has grown dramatically, 46%. Over that 10-year period, with service growing by just 16%. And that's important because what it says is we're getting more ridership utilizing our service. Essentially, it's filling more empty seats. And so it's getting very efficient in terms of being able to attract those additional riders. The two bottom bars are another key element that tell a different story. Population growth, 27% over that decade, but vehicle miles traveled, kind of auto use measure, which is obviously an important figure, is really growing at a late rate lower than that population. Over the last decade, Portland region was one of the few communities that could say that, New York City as well. Probably during the recent run-up in gasoline prices, we've probably been joined by a couple of other communities in this, but it is amazing to be able to see that. And in fact, our daily vehicle miles traveled over this decade has reduced by 8%, whereas national average has increased by 8%. Now, over the last, the last year with high gasoline prices, we're going to probably start seeing some different trends across the country, but I think we'll still see ourselves out in front. Well, about sustainability, there for us, it's really three elements that are key. And although I think that many people can use different definitions of sustainability, the one I think is most important really is captured in the fact that we want to preserve for future generations the same range of choices that this generation has. And I think the Native American cultures have really dealt well with it by really talking about the seventh generation, and that is, are you taking actions today that will, in fact, benefit, at least maintain that seventh generation out? We focus on it in really three areas. One, the transportation, the actual operation, the service level we provide. Second, on operations, that is, how we run it, how do we do our business side of it. And then we construct a lot in the Portland region for transit, and how do we really make sure that that construction is sustainable. I might add also on the sustainability, we really think of it as three legs of a stool. One is certainly the economic leg, that is, that it is sustainable from an economic standpoint. Two, that it's sustainable from an environmental standpoint. And three, that it's sustainable from a social equity standpoint. For those of you who have watched maybe some of the lawsuits that have occurred in other parts of the country, you recognize that social equity side is very important. Los Angeles is under court order right now because what they had been accused of and were found to have violated was that they were putting out their most, the best service, the newest machinery, other things in neighborhoods that were predominantly higher income and predominantly non-minority populations. They were sued and lost and found themselves operating differently. We have always looked at our service by census tract and track it very closely, because some of our best ridership is in those lower income neighborhoods and minority populated neighborhoods, we've always put our best service in that area, most frequent, newest service, and so on. And so it really has, in fact, reflected very closely our commitment to social equity as well. Well, first let me talk about the transportation itself, the service that we provide. 71% of our riders, as I said, are choice riders. 43% of adults in the region at least ride twice a month. We estimate that we take out about the 200,000 car trips a day. And what it really does mean is 59% less greenhouse gas emissions per mile compared to driving alone. And when we think about the issues around climate change, we recognize how important that issue is. It also is that we are creating communities that are more inclined both to take transit, but also to be able to have areas where they can walk or bike to be able to have some of their essential services. We also look at the economic effect of the investment in the infrastructure around transit. Since the light rail line was first announced, that is, people could rely that it was going to be built, the west or the east side in began really in 1980, although opened in 1986, and on through West Side, Interstate Max, and the light rail to the airport, we have seen $6 billion invested within walking distance of Max platforms. And that is for businesses who want to be able to have an easy access for their employees. It is for residences who want to be able to have that access as well. It is very, very important. Activity. We also like to make sure that we have communities that aren't necessarily either dependent for most or for many of their trips on either their car or necessarily even on public transit. And so we oftentimes refer to the trip not taken. This photograph is in the Pearl District, and it's really what you see is the Portland streetcar. It is really looking at how do we really make and provide for, as it's highlighted there, the trip not taken. And what we find is that when the people are in a denser neighborhood such as this, that they have, in fact, made use of being able to walk, to take public transit, or to be able to bike in much higher numbers. In fact, if you look at a survey of the Pearl District and near in northwest Portland, it's an area in which I live, you see the results. This is compared to the Portland region as a whole, but people are about 11 times more likely to walk than they are, pardon me, to take public transit than they are in the rest of the region. They are about 4.5 times more likely to walk than they are in the rest of the region, and about 2 times more likely to bike. And if you look at the car ownership and car use, you see that reflected there as well. Vehicle miles traveled, about half the regional average, and car ownership likewise. A concept that is being pursued by the city of Portland and the region is really the concept of a 20-minute neighborhood. And the idea is that within 20 minutes, by either taking public transit or walking or biking, you can get to many of the essential services, whether it's the corner coffee shop or a grocery store, or as I sometimes like to quip, not having to use a quart of gasoline to get a quart of milk. And these numbers are really demonstrating that. It also provides a substantial green dividend by being able to have individuals in a more compact setting to be able to have nodes of both residences as well as essential businesses. Portlanders travel, the Portland region travels about 4 miles less daily than the median of the 33 largest metropolitan areas in the country. And so it really says that the land use patterns, that public transportation investments, other things are in fact really producing results. That does mean about 2.9 billion fewer miles traveled. And if you translate that to, you know, kind of what's left in a person's pocket, it's significant. Travel costs for those individuals, just over $1 billion less in travel costs. And in travel time savings, by the way, these are using metrics, the last by AAA, you see travel time savings also a substantial, well over $1 billion. What this also has meant, by the way, I should say, is it really has been, if you think about the Oregon, you know, we don't have auto manufacturing. I should really go back here. We don't have auto manufacturing or petroleum refinery. And so it really means about $800 million that Portlanders are not having to spend that would really go out of state, either for that car or those petroleum products. And hopefully that $800 million staying in the region, in the regional economy. Let me turn next to construction practices, because from our standpoint, when we build light rail, it's very important that we also do it in as sustainable as possible. We have found on the Interstate MAX project, this is one that opened in May of 2004, that by using more sustainable construction practices, we saved money. And we have found this over and over again. You'll hear about it on the operational side as well. But we have done substantial things that have really made a difference. We used, when we put in the MAX alignment in the middle of Interstate Avenue, we took out the old asphalt, ground it up, but instead of disposing of it, it went back into the roadbed as fill, and in the process saved almost $3 million because we didn't have to either dispose of it and didn't have to buy new product to be able to put in for that roadbed to be able to accomplish this. Likewise, we used not creosote treated railroad ties, but we were able to use plastic railroad ties to be able to be putting in many of our places. Ties that were made from recycled gasoline tanks from automobiles. Not only was it lighter and cheaper to be able to do this, it meant that we don't have any corrosion or leachate from those creosote railroad ties either. It really was a sounder environmental practice. And we found that that really did a lot to be able to do so. We did other things, and I'll just share a couple of these because I think they're interesting stories. Those of you who have seen the light rail alignment, you oftentimes see what are these kind of blue bollards with chains trying to be able to make sure cars don't enter into places where pedestrians will be. We had always used those out of steel. We now use them out of recycled plastic because we just found the cars didn't really bang into them. That is, the strength of the steel was unnecessary. But by doing that, one of the things that an electrified system such as light rail is, you have stray current and you have to ground everything. Well, the plastic didn't have to be grounded, so it saved us money on that as well. It just made better environmental as well as economic sense. Let me turn to the really the creation of jobs that are associated with these lines. Just maybe for people who are not real close to this, and we always kind of get into our own world, I know, here at TriMet. But all of the projects, the major construction projects for light rail, the federal government has participated with 60 cents, at least 60 cents on every dollar that is spent, 40 cents from local sources. And these dollars are, in fact, discretionary dollars. They're competitively distributed based on quality across the nation. And so when we are competing and successfully get those federal dollars, called New Starts money. It's money that would have gone, if we weren't there, would have gone to Denver or Salt Lake or Atlanta or someplace else. And those dollars are able to come to the region to create jobs and to be very important as a part of our community. When we look back across the projects that are either have been built, are being built, or are in the planning stages, you can see here on this slide that it's not insignificant. These are in job years, but just under 3,000 on the Interstate MAX project that was completed in May of 2004. The I-205 Portland Mall project, that's just finishing up construction right now, 7,600 jobs and over $260 million in personal earnings. That project will open in September of this year. And then Portland-Milwaukee light rail, which is under planning right now, about ready to move into preliminary engineering, over 12,000 jobs and almost $500 million in personal earnings. And I think as Bob Shiprack, as others have noted, that when they go by the parking lots, the construction parking lots, you know, they notice that those are mostly Oregon license plates. That is, we are employing people from our region throughout the state as well and are very important. A few other things about the jobs that are being created, and this is not our analysis, but the U.S. Department of Transportation indicates that construction of new public transportation on average creates nearly 19% more jobs than other types of construction activity. It's the nature of the type of construction activity that's there and is important. By the way, these job numbers are the construction side. It's not the, it's not our operators, it's not our maintenance people, although those are jobs also that that are able to be created, but it's really the construction side. Let me talk now a moment about our sustainable operations, and I'll get to what this photograph is about in the middle, or here in this slide in a second, but it's really important to be able to know that our operations are expensive. We are the largest user of diesel fuel in the state of Oregon, purchasing just over 6 million gallons a year. And certainly, as you see the price of diesel having gone up, and in fact, because of worldwide demand, the advantage the diesel had of being generally under the cost of unleaded, now dramatically above that cost, even as the overall price of fuel has come down, means that anything we can do to deliver higher fuel mileage for our buses, the better. One of the things that we have done, maybe a few will remember the old Jackie Gleason series, The Honeymooners, but I like to refer to the technology you see here in this photograph as NASCAR meets Ralph Cramden, the role that Jackie Gleason played. The issue for NASCAR is that they want every bit of power from their engine to go to their wheels. And so they try to find what are called parasitic loads to take off of that engine so that all the power goes to the wheels. Well, in a typical diesel bus, it's a 285 horsepower engine, about 45 to 50 of those horsepower are typically used to power things like the water pump, the air conditioning system, the air compressors and other things. And in a special arrangement we had with a nonprofit called CalStart, we developed developed with them an option of how to be able to have a slightly bigger alternator and electrify most of those other parasitic loads. What happens is we're able to get over 5% higher fuel efficiency by having, as you see in the photograph, the fans that are really the cooling fans rather than a water pump. We have done that also with the air compressor and other things, and it really makes a lot of difference. The advantage of this technology is we are also able to reduce maintenance costs. This is a higher, a more efficient system to be able to operate as well. We have also done a lot of other things to be able to make our vehicles more efficient. Buses are pulling in and out of traffic all the time, and we find that the truck chassis that is used to build buses has a lot of play in the front wheels. Well, that produces more wheel drag. We put in a stronger and stiffer tie bar in the front ends and are able to reduce that. We actually end up making sure our tire pressure, one of the things we all hear about, even on our own automobile, we actually have chips in our tires to be able to tell us remotely if, in fact, we're losing tire pressure and need to be able to increase. A whole series of things we're doing. The important part is not only is it good for the environment, because we are, in fact, reducing fuel, it is good for the our bottom line because it's saving us money. Let's talk a moment about the national policy. One of the roles that I've played is to be able to be active at the national level. In fact, as I mentioned to the chair, I'm going back to Congressman DeFazio, who's chair of the subcommittee for Highway and Transit in the Transportation Infrastructure Subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives. Asked if I could come back and talk about many of these same issues next Tuesday, and I will be there to share, because the Portland story is used oftentimes as a role model. But it's also to be able to work with other leaders. A group called the T for America, the Transportation for America Coalition, is really trying to say we've got to find ways to be able to make our transportation and public transit systems be better. It involves people from New York City, from Los Angeles, from other communities who care about these issues as we do, and to be able to really influence how that is. Our Oregon delegation is very well positioned to be able to help make in the next big transportation bill. They're authorized every 6 years, and it's coming up on the reauthorization our individual members are very well positioned. Not only Peter DeFazio, but certainly Earl Blumenauer on the Ways and Means Committee, which has to pay for these issues, and the rest of the delegation. Both Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley in the Senate also playing key roles. It also is our regional efforts, too. The regional government, Metro, as well as what we call the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, we are stressing these issues to the Congress, to the administration, about how we need to be able to integrate the kind of things that that Oregon has really done into that next transportation bill. And it's absolutely key that we are able to accomplish that. I also serve as the chair of the American Public Transportation Association Sustainability Task Force, and that's really trying to get other transit agencies to do many of the things we have been talking about. Also, I'll just mention in passing that it's important that the new Obama administration has a key person overseeing much of this from the White House, Carol Browner, who is the special assistant to the president for energy and the environment, was actually my boss, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency when I was deputy administrator from 1994 through 1998. With that, I thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. One question I'd like to ask that perhaps might be anticipating from some of the other members is just to, if you could talk a little bit more about what lessons, and you've talked about it to some extent already, you can draw from your experience that could apply to other parts of the state. I'm real conscious of the fact that we have a pretty diverse state in terms of the geography and demographics, and there's some lower population densities in other parts of the state that might benefit from your perspective too.
Certainly. First, I would say, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that any public transportation system, and again, many smaller communities do not have a public transportation system. They really have a dial-a-ride for people who are particularly in need, elderly and disabled. But for those who have public transportation systems, all of us recognize that the cost of diesel is an incredibly important part of our cost factor. We also recognize that the burning of fossil fuels is the number one contributor to global climate change. And what can we do to be able to address that? Here in Oregon, 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from the transportation sector, a little higher than the rest of the nation, not because we are more polluting, but because so much of our power comes from hydro rather than coal-fired power plants, as would the East Coast be. Having said that, any of us who can find more efficient ways to be able to have our public transportation systems work, the better. I think that applies through the urbanized areas of the rest of the state. In fact, just meeting with the general manager and one of their board members from Lane Transit District earlier this week, talking about many of these same issues, how can we really accomplish that? Number two, I think some of the steps we have taken to be able to provide quality service for that transit experience, whether it's be able to call up on your cell phone and get arrival time for buses, the ability to be able to have good graphics that help communicate how service can be provided, likewise provides that level of service. Third, we have found that in our business practices that we have learned things from the private sector that apply not just to us, a transit system, but to any businesses, and we would be happy to be able to share that. For example, we utilized Boeing's ability to be able to really do inventory control as a very effective tool for us to be able to reduce our inventory of extra parts. Well, those tools that are being used that really were developed by Boeing are something that many medium and small-sized businesses could make use of, we ought to find ways to be able to provide for more of that activity. So in a whole series of things, we are providing benefits, certainly because we're a transit system. It's probably mostly to other transit properties, but it's not solely devoted to that.
That's helpful. Thank you. Questions? Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your great presentation. I happen to be from the Lane Transit District area. I'm curious whether TriMet has tried to utilize or has utilized biofuels. I know Lane Transit District did that quite extensively for a while, and then it became, cost of it became a little bit prohibitive, unfortunately, and so it's been sort of a setback. So I'm curious what your experience with that particular utilization of fuel has been, if any.
Chairman, Representative Olvey, the answer is we have done much of the same thing that Lane did. We went to 5% biofuels, biodiesel. We thought that was an investment that made good sense when it was a little bit more expensive. It's harder to be able to justify that now. But our goal here, and I think it really was LTD's goal as well, is the ability to be able to have rapeseed, which is probably the most likely, to be able to be a rotational crop in wheat growing and therefore be able to be an Oregon product, maybe Washington as well, product, rather than being able to buy soy-based biodiesel from the Midwest or petroleum products from offshore, made good sense. And so a part of our goal in investing and buying biodiesel was to see if we could help launch the industry here, both for the refinery process, but also the actual growing of the underlying product. And rapeseed actually produces a higher volume on a per unit basis than does even soy out of the Midwest. And obviously, that would be nice for our Eastern Oregon wheat farmers as well.
Other questions, Representative Bailey? Do you have a follow-up?
Well, I was just curious what that. I guess. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious what the return the diminishing returns was. What, at what point, when it's more expensive than regular diesel, do you make the decision that it's just not in the cost structure to use biodiesel?
We are currently still utilizing 5%, but the cost differential on a per gallon basis is getting dramatic enough that that we are reassessing that. But we are still currently utilizing 5%. When diesel was at about $5 per gallon in the on the commercial side, that was less significant. Now that it's at about that $2.50 range, it's getting harder. But we are currently still using it, but assessing exactly whether we can continue. And that's going to we would like to, but it's getting tougher and tougher.
Representative Bailey,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the subject of Oregon jobs and Oregon products, can you talk a little bit more about some of the other Oregon inputs that go into the transit system, whether that's streetcars or various other components, and the impact to the extent that you have data on that of what those jobs are?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey. We try to be able to make use of local employment and local subcontracting to the greatest degree possible. And we have found that that not only brings benefit then to Oregon businesses and Oregon workers, but it's also brought other benefits. And let me just tick off a few of those. Certainly in the development of new products, we think that that is really a promising area. Portland Streetcar, which originally had to buy Skoda cars from the previous Czech Republic, now are developing the first U.S.-made prototype at Oregon Iron Works in Clackamas County. And so the ability to be able to spawn a whole new industry, this is through very significant efforts of Congressman DeFazio and Congressman Blumenauer, I think is very exciting. So in terms of product, obviously that's a very large product, that is a streetcar. But we also try to be able to buy locally. One of the things that we have done, and part of the reason why we've been able to be successful in involving minority and women-owned businesses in our construction projects, are that we have broken those contracts down to smaller bite-sized pieces. That has meant that oftentimes those firms that are either minority or women-owned businesses starting out can't bid on a $1 million contract, but they can bid on a $40,000 or $50,000 piece of a broader contract. It also means, because we receive federal funds, we cannot put in a local preference clause. It has to be available for anybody who bids. But you just don't find people from outside of the area wanting to be able to bid on small contracts. They're just too small. That has meant that a part of our goal is to be able to deliver those benefits to the greatest degree possible we can for Oregon workers and Oregon contractors.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, thanks for your presentation, Mr. Hansen. The question I have is this. It sounded as if you have a list of sustainability elements that you apply to each of the elements of your operation.
Yes.
And I don't know, you mentioned several of them, but I didn't actually see the list, kind of the checklist one might go through as you determine whether or not to do something or another. But the diesel fuel versus ethanol, whatever you're burning.
Biodiesel.
Yeah, biodiesel choice kind of illustrates, and maybe some of these other examples you just mentioned illustrate the challenges of applying such a sustainability checklist. So I'm just wondering what group decides and how you weight each of those elements. For example, it would make sense to continue what we think, burning the biodiesel, but the price is going to force you back to diesel at some point. So my question is, how do you decide when to leave the sustainability paradigm and move back to the price paradigm?
Probably the biodiesel example, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, the biodiesel is a more difficult setting to be able to apply that in by the very nature of the markets being so volatile and the fact that we're looking at really developing a market here. Let me turn maybe, not to answer your question, but let me turn to an area that I think is probably closer to what you're really getting at. We end up, when we look at any kind of capital expenditure that is, in fact, has a sustainability component, we look at really the life cycle costs associated with whatever whatever that activity is. And what is going to be the payback period for us to be able to make an investment? The issue around that the NASCAR type technology to be able to be retrofitted to our buses, we looked at that and do a cost benefit analysis against the about $15,000 worth of cost to be able to retrofit that, and then what kind of a payback period is it for us to be able to get that benefit on not only a higher fuel efficiency, therefore less diesel costs, but what's our maintenance reduction in cost, because it is a requires less maintenance. And that is a very key calculation. Generally speaking, for capital investments of that sort, we are looking at a no more than a five-year payback period, and we're generally in the range of 18 months to two-year payback. But we evaluate each investment accordingly against that kind of an analysis. Does that get close enough to what you were wanting to get to?
Hold on. Sure, please. Well, we're in the ballpark, but the question is, there's got to be a method or a technique of deciding whether we're going to go with a price market measure of what we're going to go about, or whether we're going to go with the sustainability. And I am assuming that the sustainability of this is I don't want to assume. That's why I want to know about the list, because it would seem that those elements of sustainability very often might conflict with price, with the price mechanism. And I'm just wondering how one chooses and what the process of choice is. Do you go to your constituency and say, you know, it's going to cost us a lot more for biodiesel, but it's better for the environment, and that's right at the top of the sustainability list. Therefore, we're going to spend more. I want to know about that piece of how that decision is made.
Chairman, Representative Betts, again, if I'm looking at something like, and when we look at something like the capital investment on the NASCAR type technology, and by the way, it applies in a whole series of things. Do we, in fact, recycle our transmission fluid and so on? We are looking at it in terms of a full cost analysis, and I think what oftentimes has happened is people have seen it being pitted one against another, sustainability against the economy. But what we really are doing is we're looking further out and looking at the costs that are, in fact, looking at being saved, and we're looking at a return on investment. And we think that that does, in fact, have that discipline to be able to say that it's not in conflict, that, in fact, when you look at the full costs and you look at over time, you, in fact, are making good choices. Now, the biodiesel presents a particularly, I think, a unique setting, and that is we were really seeing that as a benefit to be able to address the development of a new industry within the West, Northwest. And that, then, you're really kind of saying, you know, are you willing to make an investment with the hope that that industry is going to be able to develop? And I think that's a harder choice that can be done in just a straight dollar cent calculation. But virtually every other one of our sustainability investments are put through that very hard cost-benefit analysis, and what we find is we're saving money by being green. One other quick example, and again, it's 10 years ago, we produced over 40,000 gallons of hazardous waste from all sorts of things, spent solvents and a whole lot of things. I mean, we're a large maintenance facility, and those things are used. Today, we produce less than 500 gallons of hazardous waste. Now, what that's done is, I mean, we've installed a whole lot of things to be able to make that happen. But it saved us substantial disposal costs, because shipping up stuff up to Arlington isn't inexpensive. It's also meant that we've been able to recycle or reuse many of our products. We've been able to find less toxic material, likewise, that was cheaper to be able to do the same job. So when we looked at each and every one of those things, we likewise found that sustainability was not in conflict with the best business practices, but rather, in fact, we found we saved money as well as made things greener. That's not always the case, but we have found it to be much more often than I think that kind of popularly one would believe.
Appreciate that exchange. I think that really is at the heart of a lot of the things that we're talking about and how those two things interact with each other. Are there further questions?
Sure.
Representative Leasing, please.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. So two things. One is, I'm sure you'll be taking the message when you go to Washington, D.C. and visit our federal partners, that whether or not Oregonians conclude that what's happened there is change that we can believe in is probably directly correlated with the amount of transportation dollars that we're able to have back to Oregon. My question is, and perhaps you have this data, but I would be interested to hear about a little bit of, in terms of the data, the relationship between the increase in gas prices that people are paying at the pump and ridership, you know, behavior and ridership, the increase, you know, just a bit about that, the relationship there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chair. The answer is that we have seen ridership historically over really the past decade growing at about 3% range per year. And in transit world, you got to compare same month previous year just because there are enough variability throughout the year. Beginning last year in January, about a year ago, we started seeing our increasing ridership in more about the 5% range. As it hit summer and the high price of fuel came, we were going up into the high single digits and, in fact, into the low double digits in terms of increases throughout that period. Now that fuel prices have come down, we are not seeing the drop-off that's there. There's a little bit of a decrease in terms of the rate of growth, but it is not very much. And it appears, and we are wanting to be able to, in fact, do surveys of our riders, it appears that people, for whatever all the reasons were, and my guess is fuel price was the driving factor, but parking costs and others drove them to ride us. And once they rode us, they said, you know, not only do I save money, I can, you know, I'm a bus rider all the time. I get my reading done. I get other work done. I take the stress out of that, and they're staying with us. And that is something that we're wanting to be able to understand better, but it appears that as they move to us, they are and our ridership numbers are there, they are not walking away just because fuel prices have come down.
Thank you.
And we can give you exact numbers. I mean, literally, we track on a daily basis per either platform on light rail or bus stop exact number of boardings on-offs. We have electronic counting and can accomplish that. So it really is dramatic.
If there aren't any other questions, I want to ask one, and I'm aware of the time. We have our next person has to leave quickly, so let me just conclude with one quick question about the NASCAR technology. I was very intrigued by that. It sounds like a great story. How is that, the innovation that you created, who owns that, and are there opportunities to export that to other places? Can TriMet become the developer of new technologies for other systems?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, let me just a very brief one. This concept, the idea of developing this, wasn't first tried out on us. It was actually CalSTART, it's a nonprofit that I actually am involved with as well. They were working with the U.S. Department of Defense because obviously if you're talking about supply lines from a military standpoint, anything you can do to increase fuel efficiency, you can increase the distance for that you need to be able to have for or can have for supply lines. That technology was being developed for, as I said, for the U.S. military. What the developer of the company was developing, a large corporation, EMP, wanted to be able to try it on in the transit world, thought it was a good opportunity, and the partnership then came with TriMet being the first place that that's being developed. And we did lots of experiments and adjusted and a whole lot of other things. Now EMP is actually marketing that as an after-product retrofit available for transit buses across the country, and I think that's exciting because, again, you know, you can buy new hybrid buses, you know, buy new fuel-efficient buses, but, you know, there's the fleet is probably on average 15 years until retirement. You want a retrofit, and this is a retrofit technology.
Perhaps that's a related opportunity for TriMet to be the test market for
we like to do that.
That's terrific. Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it, and I imagine we'll have more conversation with you as the session continues.
Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the time. I do get excited by this stuff. So.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's. I'm aware that Jim Woody from ODOT is on a tight schedule, so let's invite him up and the chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission, Gail Ackerman, if she wants to come at the same time. It's terrific. I'm fortunate to be her state representative, so especially glad that she's here, and we can continue our conversation.
I didn't say I actually made
Jerry,
the code.
Jerry wanted to come up at the same time.
That's fine, please.
Right. Are you sure? I'll be quick.
You can go in whichever order you like. We're glad you're here.
It was all scripted that I was supposed to go first, but I was the one who was running late, not knowing Mr. Whitty needed to leave early.
No problem.
Commissioner Chair needs to go first.
I will be quick. We can save questions for me and go direct to Whitty. Does that make
That's
sense?
That's fine. That's fine. Thank you.
Did you have it? There it is, right there. I can do it. Okay. Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Gail Ackerman. I'm the chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission, and I'm here today with Jim Whitty, who has a title that I always forget. He's the manager of the Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. His title has changed several times. And Jerry Bohart, who is the manager of our Transportation Development Division and does all things related to transportation planning for the Oregon Department of Transportation. You asked us today to address sustainable transportation, and we're excited to talk to you about a number of things that ODOT is doing to improve the sustainability not just of its own operations, but to really create the platform, the framework for a new transportation future based upon what we sometimes refer to as sustainable mobility. Now, one of the reasons that it's vital that we move in this new direction is the challenges that were identified in the 25-year long-range Oregon Transportation Plan. We have to do a 25-year plan in order to maintain our eligibility for federal gas tax and other federal highway funds, all U.S. Department of Transportation funds. And it became really clear in the preparation of that transportation plan that we are facing very, very, very difficult challenges. First, we continue to have population growth, and we're growing faster than other states in the nation. And when you have more people, you've got more demand on your transportation facilities. We've also been fortunate, at least when we were doing this plan, that we had higher economic development and greater job growth than other parts of the country. And frankly, we'd like to see that continue into the future, even though we've got a little problem at the moment. And when you have increased economic growth, and your ports are more successful, and your businesses are more successful, and you're shipping more goods in and out, then you also have more demand on the transportation system. The economy has changed, and we're dealing in a global economy that continues to demand just-in-time service, and it's one of our competitive advantages, but it's also a big challenge. And the challenges of climate change are acute, and I'll be talking a little bit more about that in the future. And as we saw this summer, in case we weren't aware of it before, the uncertainties of global oil supply and increasing fuel prices and now fuel volatility are real challenges for the transportation sector. We continue to struggle with land use transportation integration. I'm sure all of you hear about that from your constituents in terms of whether or not the transportation facilities really complement and integrate with the land use plans. We have over 300 different separate jurisdictions that run our transportation system in Oregon, in addition to probably at least dozens, if not hundreds, of private companies. So the railroads are private, the ports are special districts, all of the counties, all of the cities, all of the transit districts, all of which are separate special districts, govern, own, and operate this system. People expect it to work like a system. But we've got over 300 owners and operators, and we don't have any governing body the way the Western Utilities Regulatory Council, which coordinates transmission, does. And as you all know, we've got inadequate funding. So what is sustainable transportation? I think that sustainable transportation to me means that we're building strong communities with transportation strategies that result in a robust economy that is served by transportation services so that businesses can get their workers to work, the workers can get home from work, the inputs for the manufacturing can get in, and the goods that are manufactured can get out. And if you're a retail store, your inventory gets delivered, and your customers can come and go. Improved environmental quality, and there are tremendous opportunities for making transportation facilities actually complement and help restore the environment rather than have adverse environmental effects, and improve quality of life by integrating the community and transportation development in a way that people and businesses have transportation choices where they spend less time stuck in traffic jams, they spend less time waiting for what they need in their day-to-day lives to deliver, and less time hopefully running around in ways that no one would consider driving for pleasure. So this is what we found. We saw those challenges. We had a vision for a sustainable transportation system, and in the 25-year transportation plan that really fed into the Governor's Transportation Vision Committee, we embarked upon some key initiatives, and these are prioritized. First and foremost, we've got to maintain the existing system and keep it from falling apart. We inherited a multi-billion dollar asset, and maintaining that system has real sustainability elements, because if we can keep that existing system functional and not have to replace it and not have to tear down bridges, and if we can upgrade the materials that are used in those facilities so they are more sustainable, that's great value for all of us. The second thing we have to do, and this is a real change in thinking, is to realize that building new capacity, building a new lane, building a new interchange doesn't necessarily improve the operational efficiency of the system if you look at it as a system. Half of the congestion that occurs on our roads and highways has nothing to do with how many lanes there are on the roads or highways or the configuration of the facility. It has to do with things like wrecks and spills that just snarl everything up, and that's operational. That, and there's a lot more that we can do, and frankly, this is an economic development opportunity area in terms of developing new intelligent technology, intelligent transportation systems that time signal lights, that sense when there's traffic and how much, and adjust things like ramp meters. Intel and other companies are doing a tremendous amount of work on this, as is Garmin right here in Salem. I mean, although it's aviation here, the GPS systems in cars are a big part of this. We integrate transportation, land use, economic development, and the environment so the systems fit together and complement one another. We try to break down the jurisdictional fragmentation. We develop a new funding system. And then once we've done all of that, we recognize we are going to have to invest strategically in new capacity. There are places, there are communities where we have to add lanes. We have to put in new interchanges. We have to put in entirely new roads. If you look at the sustainability question, as many people are now, nationally and internationally, you have to look at climate change. And if we are serious about our climate change, greenhouse gas emission reduction goals, you have to look at transportation. Because in the United States, it's 32%. Of the total emissions. So it's a very significant part of the total emissions, and we can't reach the reduction targets without tackling it. And probably at least as significant, if not more significant, is that if you look at the 1990 to 2006 period, emissions from the transportation sector have actually risen more than emissions from agriculture, residential, commercial, or industry. So it's going up. So how do you reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector? And this leads into a lot of the sustainable mobility conversations. There are basically four things you can do. You can use lower carbon fuels, which we were talking to Director Hansen about, so you can switch the kind of fuel you're using to electric or biodiesel or ethanol. You can use cleaner, more efficient vehicles so that you can improve the aerodynamics of both trucks and cars so that they consume less fuel, and you can adopt fuel emission standards so that they consume less fuel. But you also are going to have to tackle reducing the number of vehicle miles traveled, and in the freight sector, which is a really critical part of our economic vitality, you're going to have to look at mode switch, although trucks are always going to be with us because they're the end point of the delivery system, and they are clearly the most economical mode for many types of freight. You've got to look at marine and rail and multimodal revitalization, and then again, by optimizing system function, you can reduce congestion, and then cars just aren't sitting there pumping out exhaust. If you increase transportation choices, and this is a critical part of our strategy, you can actually reduce the number of vehicle miles a person travels in a day. And you could do this slide for Eugene, for Corvallis, for Portland, for Medford-Ashland, where all of our great transit districts work and where our city governments have been really working to provide people with choices. What you see is that compared to the rest of the United States between 1990 and 2000, while their VMTs were all going up, ours were going down. And we're just about the only metropolitan area in the country that we can say that. But, and this is something where our analysis indicates that the national experts haven't quite got it all right yet, is that you can't get the greenhouse gas emission reductions, you can't achieve the sustainability objectives just by reducing the number of vehicle miles traveled. Because if you look at the travel and land use trends in the Portland area, you can see that the VMT has continued to go up even though sprawl has been reduced through the urban growth boundary. And what is this? Why does this happen? It's because as we've switched lifestyle patterns, and you've got two people in a household working, and the kids are in childcare, and you're going out to dinner because you don't have time to cook, and you're going to the gym because you don't walk to work, then what you end up doing is you end up making a whole lot of additional trips. And this isn't the most elegant chart, but as you work more, your commuting increases, the number of cars you own increases. Probably when you were growing up, like when I was growing up, we had one car. And now people, it's not unusual to have people with three cars, particularly if they have teenagers. So then you've got more miles being traveled. You aren't staying at home as much, and so you're not cooking. Your consumption increases. That means more goods going to the store. You're not going shopping, so that means the FedEx truck or the UPS truck is coming to your house. And so there's a lot of things other than just sprawl that are driving this increase in how much we travel. And so that goes back to that point about providing people with choices so they can walk or they can cycle or they can take mass transit. And you redesign your streets, as we've done with the Main Street as a Highway program in cities like Joseph and Grants Pass, where we've really revitalized the main streets of town so people can feel safe walking, and they've got a place to park a bike, and they've got a place they can actually pick up the transit service. When you look at the greenhouse gas emissions, however, you look at the fact that cars and light-duty trucks are certainly, they're well over 50% of the problem, but those light-duty trucks and the other trucks and the aircraft, and they're a big part of the problem, too. So you can't look at this just as a how do people behave, how do passengers behave. You've got to start looking at the freight sector, and you have to recognize that the differences in energy intensity, the BTUs per ton mile that it takes to move goods, air freight is really intense, and truck is quite intense. And if we can move by ship and barge and rail, your energy intensity goes way down. And so that has all kinds of benefits economically. If you're a business, if you can go to those less energy intensity choices, and that's we have to think about transportation choices, not just for people, which is where the public policy conversation tends to go, but also for freight, so that our shippers can have competitive options in their business that reduce their environmental footprint. That's why Connect Oregon has been so important. That's why the governor's commitment to a multimodal investment package and continuation of multimodal investment in Oregon is so incredibly important, because that's where we get the transit investment, that's where we get the rail and air and port and the intermodal hub connections that make the integrated system work. So what do we need to do for the future to achieve our sustainability objectives, and how does it relate to economic development? The first is pricing to reduce the vehicle miles traveled, so that the high value vehicle miles, the ones where the ambulance is going to the hospital, or the Intel chips are going to the airport, or the lumber is going from the mill in Mill City to the port of Portland, so that it's not caught up in congestion. And if you choose to run to the 7-Eleven to get a gallon of milk and go on I-5 in Wilsonville to do it at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, mm-hmm. you're going to pay a premium price, because your trip, frankly, doesn't have as much value to Oregon's economy as that load of lumber going from Mill City to the port. So how can we use price signals to get folks to recognize the differential value to the economy of and to them personally of the various trips they make? The Governor's Jobs and Transportation Act also calls for moving to a least cost planning model. This is new. We'll be one of the first states, and Washington has it in rule, but they haven't done statute and rule. They haven't done much with it yet. And we are going to figure out how we can figure what a strategic investment is, looking at the environmental and economic costs, not just the straight cost benefit on how much it costs to pour the concrete. Multimodal revitalization through continuation of Connect Oregon 3 and increased investment in transit systems throughout the state. And finally, and this is what Jim is going to be addressing in the Jobs and Transportation Act, is the infrastructure for the new vehicles and the new fuels, so that Oregon will be at the cutting edge on the international deployment of the new, more sustainable vehicle and fuel technologies. And Jim can tell that story much better than I, and he's the one who's on a short time frame. I'll stick around and be happy to answer your questions later, but I think I'll turn it over to Jim right now so he can get to his next commitment.
Thank you. Let's save the questions and go right ahead, please, sir.
No. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm James Whitty. I'm the manager of the Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. This office houses the legislatively created Oregon Innovative Partnerships Program. This program was created basically to leverage ODOT's existing assets and resources to get private sector investment into various projects and initiatives. Now, on the issue of climate change, we've conceptualized several energy-related initiatives under this program. And they are the Solar Highway, the Alternative Fuels Network, and the Electric Vehicle Charging Network. So we'll take the Solar Highway first. This initiative started with this office and was approved by the Oregon Transportation Commission and is now underway. Basically, we enter into innovative partnerships with the private sector to secure financing, design, construction, operation, and maintenance of solar projects on ODOT facilities, particularly the right-of-way. Now, the nation's first solar highway project you may have seen, and it certainly came forward in the news media last summer, and that's the solar array, a demonstration project at Interstate 5 and I-205 in Tualatin. The department does not own that array. It does not maintain that array. Private sector partners do that. Instead, we purchase the electricity from that solar array under an agreement called a solar power purchase agreement. And there's the picture there in the testimony. You can see the Interstate 5 and I-205 there. In future solar highway projects, third-party developers will use tax and utility incentives to finance the solar systems on buildings and grounds owned by ODOT, and then sell that electricity back to ODOT. What makes this work are basically the tax credits for the system, business energy tax credit, the federal investment tax credit, and then accelerated depreciation under federal tax law, as well as utility incentives. The good thing about this is that the electricity generated and sold to ODOT will be at no greater cost and likely less than the agency pays under its current utility tariff. We're talking about green energy at less than what we get for brown energy today. Now, ODOT uses 45 megawatt hours a year to operate and maintain the state transportation system, and we estimate that if we put solar panels along 120 miles of our right-of-way, that would be sufficient to provide the green energy needed to annually operate and support our transportation system. Now, the potential, of course, is even higher. In that we have many more miles than 120 miles of right-of-way. In the near future, we intend to issue a request for proposals to get private sector firms to help develop projects for up to 2 megawatts of solar energy. And this is the first significant step. Now, it's important to let you know that the speed at which we can achieve the vision of the solar highway will depend upon public policy adjustments by the legislature and the Oregon Public Utility Commission. There are some public policy impediments to doing this in a very quick manner because, of course, nobody contemplated the solar highway when they established some of these policies. The Alternative Fuels Corridor Initiative. It's certainly more apparent now than it was, say, 6 or 8 years ago, that more motorists are driving non-traditional vehicles. We particularly notice the hybrid electric vehicles. Now, vehicles using other alternative fuels may be available. We've had compressed natural gas for quite some time, but widespread adoption of those vehicles waits for an alternative fuels market to develop. Emergence of new, we're talking about biodiesel, ethanol, electricity, compressed natural gas, and even hydrogen. What the hindrance to adoption of these vehicles is simply lack of a distribution network. The commercial stations do not simply put these alternative fuels for availability. The department plans under the Alternative Fuels Corridor Initiative to develop alternative fueling stations on ODOT property. With these stations, we intend to give a boost to development of an alternative fuel distribution network by incubating demand for alternative fuel vehicles through the predictive availability of alternative fuels at convenient and easy to find locations. Now, we hope to select private vendors under a public-private partnership to build these evenly spaced alternative fuel stations every 40 or 50 miles or so on ODOT property along the highways. The most helpful locations might be likely be roadside rest areas because of their ready access on and off the roadway. So the private vendors here will design, construct, finance, operate, and maintain the alternative fuel stations. Now the best chance for success was along a highly traveled facility, such as Interstate 5. And 1 year ago, ODOT engaged Washington and California to determine their interest for a three-state project on Interstate 5 from border to border, U.S. borders. By mid-year, we signed a memorandum of understanding to develop that corridor, and Oregon and Washington are currently planning a joint procurement of private sector partners to provide these services. California wants to make it a three-state procurement, but they have legislation they have to pass to be able to do that. So these alternative fuel stations along Interstate 5 would provide biodiesel and ethanol at higher blends than currently available at commercial stations. We wouldn't want to compete with existing commercial stations. That's not the point. But basically provide what they do not provide today. And these stations would also provide electric charging stations and for electric vehicles and compressed natural gas. Now, in keeping with the governor's arrangement with the province of British Columbia, at least one station would provide hydrogen. With this corridor, we intend that the corridor along Interstate 5 create a backbone of supply for a privately operated alternative distribution network to emerge. We don't intend this to be the only network. We want the private sector to take it on, but they need this backbone in order to have confidence that people will actually start to purchase the alternative fuel vehicles. We will add other fuels as they become available and are viable with production and vehicle availability. The Oregon Electric Vehicle Charging Network involves the view that in a very few short years, we will have the availability to Oregonians of all electric vehicles that will be available for essentially commuting in the early years when they have a shorter range. Every major auto manufacturer has announced highway speed electric vehicles will be available in the marketplace in the next 18 to 24 months. Through our governor's efforts, Oregon will be the first point of introduction. Indeed, Nissan has signed an agreement with us to introduce the company's new line of electric vehicles here. While operators of electric vehicles will surely charge up at home, the biggest challenge for motorists will be to find a place away from home to make sure that they can get a charge to extend their ability to travel, essentially between cities and towns, but also in large urban areas. To anticipate and meet this need, the ODOT is laying the groundwork for statewide electric vehicle charging stations. These places of charge will be like at park and ride, motor pools, campuses, right-of-way, or private property such as retail and office space. ODOT's initial work involves establishing consistent standards and uniformity in construction, such as a network so the public will recognize and have confidence in the infrastructure deployed. Establishing standards now will ensure future facilities will not require expensive retrofitting. We'll also negotiate price agreements with charging station manufacturers and make them accessible to local governments, utilities, and others. This will allow the private sector and public agencies to avoid the expensive cost of procurement because we will have them available for basically signing up on a work order contract. We believe this establishing this electric charging station network will assist the widespread development of electric vehicles. I think I'll finish here and let the questions come. Yeah.
Thank you. Are there questions? I have a few. If others don't, but I defer to the others if you have some. Representative Gillian, you look like you have a question.
I have for you.
Oh, all right. Representative Bailey. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious on the solar highway initiative here. You mentioned business energy tax credit. I'm curious to the extent how useful was that in developing this initiative and what kind of partnership was there with the Department of Revenue on that?
With
that program.
With the Department of Revenue on that program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mealy, the business energy tax credit was very important to make the business deal come together. And without it, the business deal would not have come together. We simply used what was available by statute, and there was no particular partnership with the Department of Revenue. We did work with the Department of Energy, which approves the tax credits.
Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. So we kind of have a if we build it, they will come philosophy here. In the context of a very difficult session, this is not the Ways and Means Committee, which I've been reminded of, but
thank goodness.
What do you need from us in this cycle to make this network move forward?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, we are anticipating hiring a private sector firm to invest capital along the alternative fuels corridor in Interstate 5 at their own cost. And we believe they'll do it. We've had we took up
the need for the statutory change.
Yes, there are statutory changes required both on a state level and on a federal level, but we know that the private sector is interested in providing these services. To make it work, you don't only have to provide the alternative fuels, you have to provide additional ancillary services. And what we're talking about is probably food and sundries. We did an economic study that determined that that was a minimal level of commercialization that will allow the profitability of the alternative fuel stations.
Hmm. Explain to him why you need a statutory change.
Please go ahead.
Okay.
I have a follow-up.
I mean, I think that would be...
Could you explain to me why you need a statutory change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, commercialization is not allowed at the federal level at this time. There may be some rule changes that could happen that could allow it, but on the federal level, there's a prohibition for general commercialization, even a small commercialization like this in rest areas.
And what's the statutory change that might be needed at the state level, or is it only federal?
On the state level, it's really more a matter of confirming that ODOT has the authority to do this. We believe we do, but we've received advice from the Department of Justice that they would like it if we confirmed that.
Understood.
You've probably been in this position before.
Understood. We'll be interested in continuing that conversation as that gets developed.
So you don't anticipate seeing any of the statutory issues here because it's mostly federal?
Well, Representative Gilliam, the discussion that was just, if I understood it correctly, there's certainly it's necessary to have a federal change, but it may also be helpful to have clarifying language at the state level, if I understood that correctly.
Which yes. We might see?
Correct, okay. Perhaps. Yeah. So that's helpful. If there aren't other questions for Mr. Witt, Representative Holby?
My question really wasn't for him. As well, maybe it is. The alternative funding manager piece, of your title, so I'm assuming that means that you're looking for funding for these alternative transportation modes, not traditional ones. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, the alternative funding part of it really has to do with developing a new revenue system for the roadways, the highways, and it's not a part of my presentation today, but it's just another piece of our work.
I had the opportunity to be on the Transportation Committee last session, and some of the most interesting presentations we heard were from Mr. Witte, just in terms of innovation, things that are going on in transportation, a big part of which is the funding mechanism generally, so perhaps
right, so now I have a follow-up, now that he's clarified that. In combining the two presentations that we just heard, in regards to the energy intensity diagram or a chart that we were shown where rail is much, much less intensive than many other forms, and our state is faced with some rail issues where we have a rail line that was attempted to be abandoned, and now we're in the process of looking at how to save that rail line with the Port of Coos Bay stepping in, and where the state is going to be able to step in and help with that funding, perhaps, to accomplish that. I'm just kind of wondering what the take is on those sorts of scenarios, because I imagine it's just not that specific rail line, that there will be others in the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, when you're working with public-private partnerships, you're looking for underutilized value or unutilized value that the state has to then attract private capital. So in the case of these two of the initiatives we have here that I've talked about, we're using land, and we have a lot of it. So that's what you look for in a public-private partnership. The state has to put up something, so you put up something. The state wants to put up something that we're not really using much of, but has value, and then now the private sector can match it with capital, and so you look for the same kind of thing in a rail situation or anything else, and you don't know it until you look.
We hope you can come back with some more updates on those things as well.
Chair Reed, Representative Holby, I would add that as we've had a conversation, the legislature in 2007 asked the Oregon Department of Transportation to do a comprehensive assessment of our rail assets, short line, main line, all of our rail assets in the state. That study is underway now. One of the questions that the commission is very interested in, and we've had conversations with Kelly Taylor, the head of our rail division, as well as with Mr. Witte, is do we have the authority that we need and the ability that we need to invest in rail assets as a state, if that's a cost-effective transportation investment, looking at the sustainability factors and all the other prudent factors you'd look at as you make an investment, whether it's that Coos Bay rail line or many of the other short lines around the state. We've learned a lot through Connect Oregon. The short answer that I was given by Mr. Witte and Ms. Taylor when I asked them, do we need any authority, is no. And the reason we don't need the authority is because of some legislation that this body passed a few years ago that gave us broader authority in the rail area. And then if that isn't enough, the authority through the public-private partnership program that Mr. Witte administers provides us with the tools that we need to enter into these kinds of agreements. We do have a few of these areas, like the rest stations, where we may need a little point of clarification. But basically, you've given us the authority to be able to make those investments when it makes sense.
Unless there are other questions for Mr. Witte, let's let him get on his way. Thank you for sticking around. I realize we perhaps made you a little bit late, so we appreciate your willingness to stick around. Thank you. And Ms. Bard, if you have any comments, perhaps we could hear those and then continue our questions.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair and Committee. My name is Jerry Bohard, and I'm the Division Administrator for the Transportation Development Division. And one of my other responsibilities is to co-manage the sustainability program that we have in the agency, and I share that responsibility with Joan Plank, the Chief of Staff. The other aspect of this is I certainly serve as chair of our Sustainability Council. This is a council that Director Garrett put together a little over a year ago with broad representation across the agency. It's one of probably the few opportunities where members from the regions, project delivery, maintenance, facilities, planning, we all get together to talk about sustainability. And one of the first assignments has been to update our sustainability plan. And I've provided you with the volume one of that. The other thing that I would say is that we do have a staff person, obviously very involved in the sustainability program, and she's in the audience, Margie Litsky. And she actually came from the Columbia River Project Office, but recently became our sustainability program manager about 2 weeks ago. So she's relatively new to the position. So the idea of this volume one, I think you all remember a little bit of history back in 2001 when the Sustainability Act, the legislature passed that, identified a number of objectives for the state agencies to look at internally with regards to our processes. Also in that, there was a number of executive orders that was passed. One that, both in the act and in the executive order, talked about the governor's sustainability board, and then also required each of the state agencies to develop a sustainability plan and also to identify a sustainability coordinator. Obviously, both things that the agency has done. Our first plan we actually did back in 2004, and in that one of the requirements was to identify three key actions. One which Chair Ackerman has spent a lot of time talking about, and that was kind of revisiting our vision for sustainability within the Oregon Transportation Plan. The other was to work with our maintenance shops to develop an environmental management system, and then also through the OTR process where we looked at our bridges and doing a program that was more sustainable. So given all of that that's happened, we recognize the need to revisit our sustainability plan. And I won't really, the other thing that's in here, it talks about some of The mandate talks about some of the challenges. Clearly, Commissioner Ackerman has highlighted those. We also did a little work and really kind of looked at what other organizations, other DOTs were doing with regards to sustainability. Saw a lot of similarity, a lot of themes with regards to the definition of sustainability, whether you were looking at the Act. We actually went to Europe. Obviously, you know that I think they're kind of ahead of the curve with regards to sustainability.
They didn't go to Europe on state expense.
Excuse me. I meant the literature. Thank you, Commissioner. But really, some of the themes there about basic access and the development needs of individuals and companies, and to really look at the three-legged stool of environmental and economic and efficiency. So all of that is within this first context. The other thing that I think is probably a little unique about this plan is that kind of the recognition that, as I think Jim talked about, is to think about things differently. The majority of the travel that you take is not about the travel. It's about going to work. It's about getting groceries. It's about going to the gym. And so how can we complete those tasks and reach those goals with not necessarily doing something different with regards to our travel, increasing our travel options? Movies, for example. It used to be that you used to have to go to a movie theater. Now you can rent a movie, and you can also rent a movie off of your TV. So there's different options with regards to some of the activities that we do, and that's kind of the theme in here as well, is to kind of have us look at things differently. And then I would just also note within this, we have a Volume 2 and a Volume 3. And the intent of those is to really look, in Volume 2, to look internally, to identify short-term and long-term goals, performance measures within our processes, and then externally about the transportation system. And we framed it around seven kind of focus areas, again, similar to what we've seen in other organizations, health and safety. It's a basic need, whether you're talking about an employee or whether you're talking about a citizen. Social responsibility, environmental stewardship, land use and infrastructure, energy use, climate change, material resources. You heard Fred Hansen talk about that with regards to TriMet. Clearly that is an issue for the agency as well, looking at the life cycle costs of our construction material and keeping that in mind as we do our work, and obviously economic health. The other part of this plan, and it's within the testimony that I provided to you, is really some of the activities that we've been doing to kind of keep tab of all the things that we're doing relative to sustainability. We're actually up to about 10 pages, and I've just highlighted a few in the testimony. Some of the annual reporting that we have to do for the Division of Administrative Services with regards to energy use and fuel use. Jim talked about some of the cost savings. What we've done with some of our traffic and our signals is we've retrofitted those, and in case of Region 1, they've saved over $100,000 in their electrical costs just by retrofitting some of their traffic lights and signals. Public transit, clearly one of the missions of public transit is to help other communities to look at alternative modes, other options. Connect Oregon, as referenced by Commissioner Ackerman. And then even there's a federal program called Safe Routes to Schools. Allows us to do some education, perhaps some projects with communities and with the school districts to give children opportunities to walk and ride to school safely. The numbers of children that have driven to school now has gone up exponentially. So trying to make some changes there. Participated in what we call truck stop electrification, so that trucks can now hook up in some of our plazas to electricity rather than having diesel run overnight because of their refrigerated trucks. So it's really just quite a diversity of things that we're involved in, and that's what we're going to try and highlight as we go through this plan. So you see we finished Volume 1. We're very close to finishing up Volume 2. And then we'll start working on Volume 3 with regards to the entire transportation system. So I thank you for your time.
When do you expect that Volume 3 might be completed?
Chair Reed, we're hoping probably within about a year. We've started to put the outline together, and we figure it will take us about a year to flesh that out.
Interested in following that. Are there questions? Wow, you've stunned our audience. Are there questions generally to take the discussion back out to the larger considerations of the presentation we heard from our Transportation Commission Chair? You stunned them. I was wondering about in the larger context. I was particularly intrigued with how you talked about the values, the differing values of different sorts of trips, and it has intrigued me to think about how do you communicate that to people short of the pricing signals, sort of recognizing the political challenges of implementing and deciding on a structure that would do that. Are there places that can help us get to that before we settle on what the structure is and implement it exactly?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, we're learning as we go, and I'm very proud of the fact that Oregon is really at the forefront in the United States in leading towards sustainable mobility, which is why we have so many international companies that are very interested in deploying their products here. But in terms of this fundamental question of driver behavior and driver choice and the comparative sort of social economic value of various trips, I don't think anybody wants to have government making those kinds of choices for them. And certainly road pricing and variable road pricing is one way to send those kinds of signals, and that's the kind of signals that electric utilities send all the time. So it's pretty well accepted in the electric utility business that depending on what time of day you're turning on your appliances, you could have variable rates. And certainly for business, that's the case. I think the best example in that there are two fundamental things that need to be done to enable people to have choices, and that's what this is all about, so that they have maybe three, so that they have choices that will allow them, consistent with their lifestyle choices, to decide not to drive in a single occupancy vehicle. One is you have to have the transportation infrastructure, the complete streets for bike and ped and light rail, so that you actually can get from point A to point B in something other than a single occupancy vehicle. And that's not always possible in all of our communities right now. Two is that, and this is an area where former State Representative Tom Ryan was really a leader, the current chair of the Washington County Commission, and Metro has been implementing a Drive Less, Save More educational campaign. Mothers Against Drunk Driving have shown the value of social marketing, and we all changed our behavior. Yes, there were law changes, but there were also social cultural changes about how we drink and that we don't let our friends drink and drive. Well, the Drive Less, Save More campaign and programs like the Travel Smart program in the city of Portland and a number of the other transportation demand management programs that other usually transit agencies run around the state really educate people on what their choices are. And that kind of public education and outreach to just suggest to people how they can do trip chaining so that they can combine their trips and not go back and forth and back and forth. When the gas prices were really high, that's what people started to do. But those public outreach and education campaigns are very successful, and to the extent that they can reduce vehicle miles traveled and we don't have to expand a facility at tremendous capital cost, investing in transportation demand management is extraordinarily cost effective. Now, we've got to be really careful to evaluate the results, but all of the programs we're funding have evaluation components. The third area, which ODOT hasn't gotten involved in, and ODOT I don't think ever will get involved in, but you as legislators might be interested in, and Representative Witt has particular probable expertise, I would think, is the labor policies. Depending on what people's hours of work are and when the workday starts and when the workday stops and whether or not you can work from home one day a week, those labor policies have a direct effect on people's travel patterns. And so you can have a very profound impact on travel patterns through your labor policies. And that is totally out of my area of expertise. So three ways to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman, I hesitate to ask you this question because I know you're really good at planning and what you do, having worked with you so many times, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
Okay.
It seems that the better you do your job, the more people come to Oregon, and the more you got to do your job. And so, just curious, it seemed that your presentation would go to how wonderful things are going to be, and then we're attracting lots more people to Oregon, and I thought, man, that seems inconsistent. But I'm sure that, I'm just going to anticipate a little here and say that you're going to tell me that you're going to do your job so well it won't matter that we add another million people. Is that what I'm going to hear?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Vance, you sound a lot like my husband. he was a founding member, I think, of the James G. Blaine Society. But I think the answer to the question is the answer you just stated. We have to figure out how we can do, we can provide transportation facilities and infrastructure for businesses and for people in a way that maintains our quality of life. And that is very, very challenging. But when you look at the population density in Oregon right now, and you compare it to the population density in many other parts of the world where people have very high quality of life, I think we can maintain our quality of life and absorb the people that I think are inevitably going to be moving to Oregon if we really think these things through in advance and we figure out how to do our new transportation infrastructure in a sustainable way that fits in with the landscape and also do the other land use choices and, for all I know, labor policy choices that actually allow us to build a new kind of community where you can have more people and still maintain the living quality. I did have the opportunity to go to Europe on my nickel, not the States, with a sustainable development tour in June of this last year with an economic development group from the Portland metropolitan area, and we saw some communities in Malmo, Sweden, in Copenhagen, in Stockholm, that I think every one of us would sign up to live in. And one of the things coming from your districts, Representative Benz, in those areas, there's tremendous open space in those countries. So they haven't paved over the Swedish forests and the farmlands by the Baltic, and yet they have these. They have the transportation choices, and they're doing it in a very sustainable way. So I do believe it's possible, but it requires fundamental changes in the way, in the nature of transportation choices we provide to people.
Thank you.
Other questions? I think we've benefited from your help in sort of orienting us, and the things that, as the committee members have heard me say repeatedly, is that there are a lot of elements to sustainability, and this is a really important one, so appreciate your willingness to help us get oriented as we begin our exploration and discussion. So
thanks to you, and thanks to your committee, because it does have real economic development implications, not just, it's across the board.
Right.
So thanks.
Thank you. Thanks. We have a last-minute addition, if you'll indulge us for a couple more minutes. Carl Rohde from the Bicycle Transportation Alliance indicated an interest in testifying, so I'd like to invite him forward and get his comments as we continue to get oriented. Carl, please go ahead.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. For the record, it's Carl Rohde, Government Relations and Public Affairs Director for the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. I was particularly interested in coming and listening to what was being said about sustainable transportation being a representative of the most efficient and sustainable transportation method on the planet, in one that its motor is its passenger. One of the things that we look at the BTA is that the issues that bicyclists actually cause virtually no damage to the road, and the more people that we can get onto bikes, the greater reduction that we see in congestion. This has definitely been an issue in the Portland metropolitan area, where we're seeing upwards of 15,000 crossings of the four bicycle bridges on a daily basis by bicyclists in the Portland area, and this continues to grow in double-digit numbers. Bicycles produce an imperceptible amount of greenhouse gases. And when the gas prices went up so high last year, we saw it really drove a lot of people to not just transit, but also to bicycling. Like I said, we had a substantial an increase. And although we don't have the methodology that TriMet does to be able to constantly be reading the number of people that are out there bicycling, anecdotally, we have heard that the from the people who were regular cyclists 2 years ago, they're saying they're seeing just on a steady basis, even as the weather conditions change, that in fact the number of people who started bicycling last year because of high gas prices recognized the fact that it was something that they were capable of doing. It was a lot less than the amount of gas that they were paying or a transit pass, and they never had generally never had trouble finding a parking place. Last year, the Bicycle Commute Challenge, which is a statewide challenge that we run in September, had nearly 12,000 members or people sign up to bicycle, and they logged over 1 million miles. And of those 12,000, nearly 3,000 of those people had never biked to work before. And we feel that a lot of those folks, once they try it, they find out it's not as hard as they thought it would be, and they continue to do so. And the people who sign up for this come from around the state. We have people in Bend, Ashland, LeGrand, Enterprise that sign up for the Bicycle Commute Challenge. There was one man who bicycled from LeGrand to Prineville. And registered that trip, which I thought that was a dedicated. I believe he was actually an ODOT worker. But
what times did he do that?
Oh. Once. Okay. I think he just wanted to prove that he could do it. But I was in Bend at the beginning of December, and the interest in cycling in the Bend community is dramatic, and it's something that is being picked up statewide. So I think this is a very important activity to consider in the overall mix of transportation. The other thing to recognize with bicycling is that actually the infrastructure for bicycling has a very minimal cost. I recently was asked to come up with an idea for a stimulus package, shovel-ready stimulus package, so I had some people run the numbers on doing the Springwater Corridor in Portland from Boring to downtown Portland. This is a 21.5-mile bicycle-only route or bicycle and pedestrian non-motorized transportation corridor. And if we were to redo that corridor, which is currently laid out in asphalt and has some less than desirable conditions, if we were to redo that corridor 21.5 miles in a 12-foot wide strip of concrete with lighting poles every 50 feet, it would cost roughly $12.5 million. That's 21.5 miles for $12.5 million. And I would like you to compare that to an item in the ODOT STIP, which is a lengthening the merge lane of I-205 onto I-5 South by 1/4 of a mile is $15 million. So as far as a bang for your buck, and then the ability to put in this type of infrastructure is a lot less expensive than putting in the traditional modes of transportation. I do want to recognize the partnership that we have with TriMet. They have been a really fantastic partner, recognizing that bicycling often represents the last green mile. Folks that are either traveling to TriMet or traveling to home in the evenings oftentimes will take their bike for that last bit to get to transit. And TriMet and the work of Fred Hansen has recognized the importance of accommodating multi-modes, which includes getting folks to and from their transit stations on bicycle. The waiting list for bicycle facilities at the Sunset Transit Station in Beaverton has actually been about 300 people on the waiting list since the day that transit station opened. So there's an enormous opportunity to accommodate more riders to bolster this mix. I want to encourage members of the committee to join the Salem Bicycle Club as they present a breakfast on the Capitol steps next Friday the 30th from 7 to 9 a.m., an opportunity to meet some of the local area cyclists. And then in April, on April 21st, the Oregon Bike Summit will be held here in Salem, and we hope to organize a legislative legislative ride around the Capitol, including we're working with one of the local Portland pedicab operators. For those who might not want to power the cycle on their own, we'll bring one down and they can go for a ride. So thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
I think that pedicab thing might be a little unfair. We might have to figure out some way for people to earn that. We have just a couple of minutes remaining before we need to get out of the way of the next committee here. But are there any questions for Carl? This might be the opening of our conversation, so we expect we'll probably be talking to you again. Appreciate you being here and helping us get oriented. So thanks very
much. Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you. Just to give you a little taste, we're likely to continue our conversation on the transportation and sort of commerce intersection on Tuesday, hoping to have some folks here from ports. And we're starting to get some bills in the possession of the committee. I encourage members of the committee, if you have particular concerns or things you'd like to see us taking up quickly, to let me know. And unless there are any other comments for the good of the order, we'll close the informational hearing and adjourn the committee. Thank you.